Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Black Power movement that emerged in the mid-1960s has cast a long cultural shadow, and while the movement is best remembered for its pioneering and uncompromising political writings and the demonstrations that took place across the country, art also played a vital role in transmitting the movement's message. The Soul of a Nation exhibit, currently underway at the Brooklyn Museum, showcases some of the work that played such an important part in one of the most significant political movements of the 20th century. You were just listening to Charles Mingus's Better Get Hit in Your Soul. It's one of the pieces of the music you'll encounter as you make your way through the Soul of the Nation exhibit. Ashley James is the Assistant Curator of Contemporary Art at the Brooklyn Museum. Hi, Ashley.
Hi.
And Ann Pasternak is the Museum's Director. Hi, Ann.
It's great to be here.
Oh, we're so glad to have both of you. So, Ann, this started out originally at the Tate Modern.
Yes.
In London. How did it wind up in Brooklyn? And what had to shift and change a little bit to bring it to Brooklyn?
Well, I got a call at 8 in the morning on a Sunday from Darren Walker, the president of the Ford Foundation.
Heard of him?
Yeah. And when Darren calls, you pick it up. So he said, Ann, there's this incredible exhibition that's going to happen at the Tate Modern. I think it's perfect for the Brooklyn Museum. Can I connect you guys? And I said, absolutely. And within a week, we had signed on to being the first venue in the United States to take Soul of a Nation. And I have to say, the Tate was an awesome partner.
When you bring a show over like that, do you take it completely as is intact, or do you end up having to change it some?
I think the best shows you always have to change. So while it's an excellent question, so while we do take traveling exhibitions, we try to make it our own and speak to our audiences. The truth is the Brooklyn Museum has done a number of historic exhibitions on Black Power and civil rights. So this was an extension of work we'd already done, and we wanted to advance the story a bit more for our audiences.
So Ashley, during this whole exhibit, there's this conversation that's happening among Black artists at that time. What were some of the elements of that conversation? I know it's set up, we'll talk about the geography of it in a second, but sort of the overarching themes, some things in that conversation.
Yeah, some overarching themes include collective art making practices versus individual practices, abstraction versus figuration, kind of what mediums Black artists are able to access and receive attention for, the question of the institution and whether or not mainstream institutions actually give space for Black artists is a major theme, amongst others.
So I mentioned that the show is divided by geography. Can you tell from where the artists are from and where they're living and they're working the influences it has on their work? I mean, there wasn't like a monolith experience across, it's like, this is what Black activists are like.
Yes, I think geography provides a kind of access point for understanding the period. It's in no way conclusive, but I do think that you see, you know, in New York is kind of where the more mainstream traditional art practices take place and institutions, mainstream institutions take root, versus in a place like Chicago, which you see is a space of community, is where artists come together in a kind of familial setting and kind of work in a less formalized way. That's one difference. LA is a third in which being outside of the mainstream New York really gave them an opportunity to access a more radical practice. So you see assemblage and you see the beginnings of performance there, etc.
And I think one of the overarching things is that artists were asking, is there a Black aesthetic? Should there be a Black aesthetic? What might that be? And so you see this as a debate really running throughout the course of the exhibition.
Yes.
Right. There's no answer.
No. And that's still a resonant question today.
We start in New York. It starts in New York. And since we're in New York, we'll start there, too. Tell me about the Spiral Group. Who was in the Spiral Group? What was their cohesive message?
Yeah, so the Spiral Group consisted of 15 painters, including Romare Bearden, Norman Lewis, Emma Amos, Merton Simpson, and a number of others, who came together really in 1963 to organize a bus to the March on Washington. So this political impetus has always kind of been there and is a question percolating in the show. And in the aftermath, they decided that they wanted to come together and just think about what it would mean to make a Black art, as Anne was speaking to, and also a related but different some point political art. So they met kind of casually to think through the question of how, as a black artist, can I respond to this movement?
There was one woman, correct, in the Spiral group?
Yes.
Well, tell me about her.
Emma Amos, also the youngest member of Spiral. She was actually a student of a member of Spiral and kind of was brought in via pedagogical practice. And, you know, the fact that she was the sole member is kind of indicative of the still gender imbalance of the period. Even within black liberation spaces, you still see that that is the case.
One of the most striking pieces is America the Beautiful. And can you describe it for our audience?
Which one is that? Is that the Norman Lewis?
Yes.
Yes.
So that's my favorite piece, and I didn't even know the title. There you have it. One of the things the artists had agreed to, maybe the only thing that they had agreed to in these conversations, was creating black and white work at the time. So this is a piece, a canvas, a good-sized canvas that's black and white, mostly black, and it looks like there are these white expressive marks on it. But as you get closer, you realize it's a Klan rally at night. It's an incredibly powerful, haunting painting that really gets you to your very, very core. And when I first saw Soul of a Nation and I saw that painting, I said, if there was nothing else great in this exhibition, it was worth it just to see this work, which is in a private collection.
It's stark.
It is.
It's really stark.
Right.
And it gets you. If there's something about it that catches you right in the solar plexus, I don't know what it is.
Absolutely.
Ashley, why, was there a significance that the pieces of work had to be black and white?
Yes. So in 1965, Spiral launched one exhibition in which the kind of cohesive theme of that show was black and white, which allowed them to access kind of political and social resonances, political and aesthetic resonances, while still kind of allowing for the elasticity of an individual practice.
There is a note about the Brooklyn Museum Community Garden around this time.
Community Gallery.
Gallery, excuse me.
Yep.
Tell our listeners about that.
Well, in the 1960s, there were protests at the museum, even back then. And, you know, people wanted to see greater representation, rightly so. The truth is that our institutions in general have had historic blinders to being truly inclusive spaces for artists. And so we hired a curator who created the Community Art Gallery, and a lot of amazing artists had shows at that time in the Community Gallery. And it lasted, I'm not quite sure how long, about
roughly 2 decades.
Yeah, so a long time. And we've been doing research about this period of our history and thinking about what can we learn from the past and carry through to the present moment. So stay tuned.
Okay. We're speaking with Ann Pasternak, director of the Brooklyn Museum, and Ashley James, the curator of the Soul of the Nation exhibit. It's up through February 3rd, so you have plenty of time to go see it. Let's talk about some of the other regions. There is part of the exhibit that's about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. What were their roles at
yes.
this time?
So that is an addition to the Brooklyn presentation here, thinking about the role of the South within this larger story. And it's a complicated question because there isn't as much of a sense of a kind of collective movement of painters there that you see in New York, for instance. But you do find that there are institutions that serve as the kind of what I call the incubators for many of the artists, politicians, et cetera, who come out of this moment and, you know, really contribute to the movement in various ways. David Driscoll, who is a artist and professor, grounds that section.
I think it's interesting that you did include the South because it's such an important part of the story, between whether it's the Great Migration or whether it's slavery. And it was interesting to me to think about the generational differences also at this time, because that's what the 60s were about as well, the generational differences. Do we have the Black Power movement, or do we work within the system? Do we see that anywhere in the exhibit, that push or pull, or is this mostly just about the young folks who want to get out there and break the system?
That's a really good question. And I think that you still see that there's an older generation involved. I mean, I think maybe an example of that is Romare Bearden is shown in Spiral, but then later on, he found Cinque Gallery in 1968. So he's still kind of involved in the movement. Someone like Betty Saar cites Martin Luther King's assassination as a real turning point for her career, even though she's a bit older than some of the other artists in the show. So I do think that intergenerationally, you do see a kind of heightened awareness, a heightened urgency around contributing to the movement.
And you know what's interesting too is that we are now starting, not we as the Brooklyn Museum, but as a larger art field, are paying more and more serious attention to these artists from this time period. So it's great to focus on these roughly two decades of work, but they've continued to make really powerful work throughout their careers. And it's time also for institutions to stand up and show what they've been doing throughout their entire lives. So they've been very influential to a younger generation of artists, but often they know about their work through publication rather than through seeing it actually in our institutions.
So what do you think that large institutions need to do to make that happen?
You know, people often say to me, Anne, I don't believe in women's shows, or I don't believe in shows about a particular, you know, demographic. And my point is that until there's real equity, we need to spotlight the excellent, extraordinary practices that were happening and also integrate them into the collections and the exhibitions that we do and spotlight the individual artists. So, you know, it's a multivalent commitment that the Brooklyn Museum has historically had, and we're just continuing to grow.
Let's talk about the West Coast artists. They were working in some different mediums than the East Coast artists. Can you tell folks about some of the work?
Yes. Yeah, so this exhibition really focuses on one type of sculpture called assemblage, which really was about taking materials that already existed in the world and recombining them to forge something new and really call into question this idea that fine art is separate from one's life and is something that you can't access in your daily life, that it's really a part of one's quotidian practice.
You know what's also interesting about that? Because a lot of that work seems very influenced by the kind of aesthetics of the South. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of artists like Robert Rauschenberg and others who seem, they must have been very clearly influenced by, you know, these artists from the South, and yet that's not something that's normally discussed in their practice.
Definitely. And that section draws heavily from the work of Dr. Kelly Jones, who makes that argument that this idea of migration and what was brought from the South is really heavily influential for LA in particular.
There's just one piece that's very striking, The Liberation of Aunt Jemima.
Yes.
Can you describe it for me?
We bought that piece. I'm so proud.
Oh, you did?
We had the Molotov cocktail.
Oh, damn. Yeah.
That one's good too. No, that's not one of the seven
that's
words.
So
don't
cute.
Worry.
yes. There's a rebellious spirit of this work, which features this racist caricature, Aunt Jemima, in a small plexi box that Miss Saar has sourced from a flea market. And she literally arms her with a rifle, a Black Power fist emblazoned in her surface. And really the work is iconographic of the period because it's really foregrounding this idea of taking this servile figure and pulling her straight into a Black liberatory future.
Especially a female figure.
Yes.
Which is why I got so excited, because it's one of the great works, and I wish we owned it. But our Molotov cocktail is in there, the show, too.
So which yes. one? Tell us about that one, the one that you bought.
Go ahead, Ashley. If you want facts, just talk to Ashley.
It's a Molotov cocktail made from one of these racist caricature bottle. And I'm not even sure exactly how to describe it. It's an assemblage piece. I can't recall the exact commercial product that it is. But again, taking this
There were all those like little Black Sambo things.
Exactly.
Whenever I'm in the South and I'm in an antique store and I see those, I put them on their heads. It's my own little
private
protest in like antique stores.
Well, you know, it's still controversial today to take these stereotypical images and share them with the world in a way that upends them. Mm-hmm. And it was a very powerful and radical thing for Betty Saar to do, and it still continues to be.
Let's look at the Bay Area, obviously the birthplace of the Black Panthers. Yeah. Emory Douglas is very prominently figured.
Yes. He and Cleveland Bellow are the two figures in that section. And Emory Douglas was, of course, the Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party. 1966 is when it forms in Oakland. And that section is really foregrounding who is an artist who is a revolutionary artists in the most essential sense of the term. I don't know if there's a more political artist in the show, but you see that he has such a specific graphic sensibility that you understand through seeing his works kind of collectively, and this the bold outlining, the radial lines, the oversized rifle, all of these kinds of indicators of revolution.
We're talking to Ashley James, the curator of the Soul of the Nation exhibit, as well as Ann Pasternak, director of the Brooklyn Museum. So that's on the fifth floor. You're on the fifth floor, and then you go down the stairs, and we leave geography, and we go more into, genre's not the right word. Is that
key terms, questions?
Formal.
Formal, yes.
But it's the second part is about style, I guess, of what I'm saying. It's about approaching the movement and the issues through the style of the work versus we're looking at this is what the New York artists were doing and this is what the LA artists are doing. What was the decision to have those two different floors, or those two different components?
Well, I was really lucky to be given that much space to think about the show here at Brooklyn. And I think it provided a real opportunity to offer up two theses, two ways of understanding the period. Because when you're looking at 20 years of art making, there's obviously so many ways to see it. So kind of drawing forth a different view, if regional offers up one kind of vantage point, then what can a key termed based kind of look offer?
When you say key term, please explain that to folks.
Okay, so some of the key terms are figuration versus abstraction, as I spoke about before, this idea of the surface, movement and action, all of these kinds of things.
After someone's been through this whole exhibit, this is sort of a different question than usually they ask people, like, what do you want people to take away from this? What wouldn't you want someone to take away from this after seeing this, Ashley?
I wouldn't want someone to think that this is the entirety of Black artistic practice during this period, because obviously there are hundreds and thousands of more artists working during the period who are doing excellent work in other ways. And I would not want somebody leaving thinking that the story is complete.
Is there an artist, do you think, that someone who possibly isn't represented for whatever reason, that you think people should check out of this period?
Sure. I think Adrian Piper is a major artist of the time period who offers a different glimpse of the late 60s in her kind of conceptual minimalist practice. And luckily, her work is on view at the Hammer right now in a retrospective.
Anything you want to add, Anne?
Well, I would just say that I hope that this exhibition encourages many other institutions to take a serious look at these artists. I've been really gratified to see a number of galleries picking up the artists from this exhibition and giving them shows during this time period. But I think now the job really is about the institutions recognizing the importance of these artists and continuing to give them shows.
Ann Pasternak, director of the Brooklyn Museum, and Ashley James, curator of the Soul of a Nation exhibit. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you so
much.
It is such a pleasure.
Thank you. The exhibit is on until February 3rd. We're going to leave you a little another piece of music from the exhibit. Miles Davis, It Never Entered My Mind. Don't go away. All of it will be back after the break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Long-running drag restaurant and cabaret Lucky Chang's has been a New York staple. When it first opened, it represented all the glamour and grit of the East Village, a place for creative people and curious people to have drinks and let it fly. A certain radio host spent quite a bit of time there in the 90s. It became sort of a bit of a tourist destination after being featured in the very first episode of Sex and the City. And like a lot of the East Village, the original location is no longer. But that doesn't mean Lucky Chang's as a concept stopped. It continued to move around the city and continued to bring drag into the mainstream. Lucky Chang's is celebrating its history and style and will be marking its 25th anniversary on Thursday, October 28th. Here to talk about the event is the evening's MC, Paulina, Princess of Power, and Josephine Jason, house DJ and co-owner of Lucky Chang. She's the daughter of the cabaret's former owner and founder. Welcome and happy anniversary, you guys.
Hey.
Thank you.
So, Josephine, when your mother first opened Lucky Chang's back in 1993, can you give us the origin story, what it was, and then how it came to be Lucky Chang's?
Yeah, so my parents met at the location. It was previously Cave Canem, which means beware of the dog in Latin. And my dad went there on his 24th birthday, met my mom, and they were my mom was pregnant 2 years later. And that's when they started Lucky Chang's together in 93.
What made them want to start this kind of restaurant,
place? They had this chemistry. I don't know. Their senses of humor just really got along well. And they just wanted to start a new concept, I think. And it ended up being a place where kind of rejects could come and work. And yeah, it was the first, I don't know, in the world, but at least in New York. And yeah, the rest is history.
If you spent any time at Lucky Chang's, we'd love to hear your story. 212-433-9692. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. If you had one of those nights that you want to remember back at Lucky Chang's in the 90s in the East Village, please do call. I wasn't joking. I spent a lot of time at Lucky Chang's in the 90s, but it was there. And it was such an interesting vibe because it was very inclusive in a way, you know. At the same time, you felt you were someplace special, but at the same time, it felt like anybody could come in and have a great time.
Yeah, that's kind of been the theme. I don't want to say theme, actually. It's just kind of been...
ethos, maybe?
Yeah, the essence over the years. It's where anything can happen. And a lot of credit goes to the drag queens for facilitating an environment like that, like Paulina. There's some gift that I know Paulina has in facilitating a place where people can let loose and attract different kinds of people into one place and let things erupt and just go anywhere, you know?
And, you know, Paulina, now we think about drag as being mainstream, but 25 years ago, that really wasn't the case.
Well, I think the beauty part of drag, especially the New York City scene, is that it's been a composite of so many different types of people that eventually it had no choice but to be pushed toward the front. Because the one thing that I consistently have said, and I had the blessing of being probably the show hostess when you were there back in the 90s and all the way through up until today, where I'm now one of the last remaining people from the original first location. So I've got to see how the community itself has changed based around, like Josephine said, what the girls put out there as what is acceptable and what is admirable and what is the standard of sex appeal and class and energy and positivity. And for a drag queen, I think it's just your life's work to make sure that for the time people are with you, you're making their ugly world prettier.
How did you first encounter Lucky Chang's? How did you come to be part of that family?
Dare I say this part?
Yes.
All right.
Oh, yes, you dare, now that you put it that way.
All right. Well, so I was in the ladies' room because we were allowed to pee anywhere in New York at the time. And as I came out of the stall, Josephine's mom, Hane, was talking to some woman in the mirror. And she turned to me and she lifted up her top and she showed me her breasts and said, which one of these is fake? And I pointed to the right one. And she called me a bitch and I was hired not soon after that. So the rest is kind of history. I figure I found my niche under the blouse, if you will.
Best job interview ever.
Yeah, it's super easy.
Lucky Chang's, though, it's interesting. The location was a bathhouse before, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back in the 70s. So we were always kind of afraid that if any of the tiles fell off during the show, it might expose some of the actual bones, if you will.
How did most people find out about it initially?
To be honest, I think it was a lot of it just the word of mouth. Celebrities found us because back in the day, that was a hot spot for finding anything you didn't want to find in the light. Mm-hmm. So people would come to the crevices of the East Village to get their freak on. And it's kind of stayed that way for as long as I had been with them until I guess maybe about 10 or so years ago, things started to dramatically shift in the neighborhood. So we've kind of been like bouncing around ever since, finding our niche, but we're kind of tight where we are right now.
That's sort of interesting. The story of Lucky Chang's is a little bit of the story of the East Village in that
way. Or the story of New York, really, when you think about it. If you don't make it there, you make it someplace else until you make it. Mm-hmm.
I just remember at those days when I worked at MTV, that's just where we hung out. I mean, it was just sort of a cool vibe place to be.
I mean, any night you were there, Tuesday, you would find celebrities macking in the corner.
Yeah, Paulina still calls it God's blind spot.
Yes.
Oh. I don't think that'll ever change.
Yeah, no, no. Shout out to Murdoch, the dirty balloon dude.
I'm not even going to ask. we're talking to Paulina, Princess of Power, and Josephine Jason, the co-owner and the house DJ at Lucky Chang's. Your anniversary, actually, October 18th. I'm sorry, I misspoke, and that's the big anniversary.
This Thursday.
So what's on store for Thursday?
Man. So
what's
you know,
not?
Actually, I'm happy you said that story, because the reason my mom had a fake boob was because she just had breast cancer and had a surgery. She had a silicone one. So a big part of this anniversary is to honor my mom's legacy.
Lovely.
And to celebrate all the work she put in, how much it's grown, and the whole community of Lucky Chang's and beyond. And so we're partnering with the Tutu Project, which is a breast cancer nonprofit. So a lot of the proceeds will go to that organization. And what else? We have vivacious DJ, RuPaul's Drag Race star,
lest
spinning.
We forget the boy diva and the drag wrestlers.
We're debuting drag wrestling.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's alone.
That's a visual.
Yeah.
And then I can pretty much be guaranteed that by the end of the show, I'll be throwing my feet in the air, so to speak, as closing out with an aerial number for everybody.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how Lucky Chang's ended up moving around, and how did you manage to keep that ethos intact and that feeling and vibe intact when you had to change locations and you were going to someplace very different? Midtown is very different than the East Village.
So see, now this is where I step in, because I've had to be the one to sort of morph each room into the same feeling, but with different sorts of rooms with every place we went. We were at the DL for a little while in a small cabaret-style room. We were at yet another location where we were in a much larger cabaret-style room. Now we're on a Broadway proscenium stage with 30-foot ceilings. So you've got to try and reach these people however you can. And my message, apart from drag queens making an ugly world prettier, is use what you got to get what you want.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a call. Rocky on line 3. Hi, Rocky.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're doing great.
This is so exciting, because I remember Kaveh Khanum, because I was one of the people, was one of the first folks who went to their soft opening. And it was a very different concept in terms of clubbing. I was somebody who went to Paradise Garage in the Loft.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
I was a little bit like, whoa, this is way upscale than I thought. But it was very nice. And then I didn't go back for a couple of years. Next thing I turn around and it's drag queen heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all those exciting girls. You come in, it doesn't matter who or what you are. You sit down and you have a damn good time.
Yes,
remember, Paulina, you're still rock, sweetheart.
Hey.
I haven't been anywhere near Lucky Chang's for a very long time, but I'm glad to hear the spirit is still going on.
That's awesome.
Thank you, Rocky. Let's go to Una in Brooklyn. Hi, Una.
Oh, hi, it's Una.
Hi.
Hi. So in the 90s, we went to Lucky Chang all the time, and I was there one night, and I had gone into the bathroom, and there was somebody who worked there, one of the wait staff, another, trans woman who's in there. And I had my hair up in a bun with two chopsticks holding it up, and she said, girl, I always wanted to learn how to do my hair like that. So I said, I'll teach you. So I taught her how to twist her hair up and stick the two chopsticks in and teach her about the physics of hair and chopsticks. And she's really appreciative, and it was really fun.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Why do you think drag has caught people's attention?
I think it's always captured people's attention since it was Shakespearean times. But I think essentially what it does now is it gives people that feel like they're farther on the fringe, more of a centerist perspective, because it's basically about beauty and creativity. It's artistry at its finest, really, when you think of it. It's makeup art and sculpting your body and styling your hair and then having all of the confidence to pull all of those elements together and present them to a room full of people, that they don't look at you for what you are inside, they're looking at you for what you are outside and receiving the message that way. And it sort of like turns off who you are as a person because you're wearing a persona at that moment mm-hmm. that people just relate to for whatever message you're trying to relay, whether you're lip syncing someone else's thing or you're singing your own song or you're just dancing. But it's more of a conduit, if you will, for just entertainment, basically.
Mm. And Josephine, what do you think Lucky Chang's legacy is?
Ooh, what a question. You know, I think what it's always been has been a place where anyone can go. Clients, wait staff, performers, and I think it'll continue to be that. I think it'll continue to be this gateway through which people will come, build their confidence, use our stage as a platform to keep growing.
We like to sort of encourage, especially of recent time, with the resurgence of drag, it's brought young people to the front, and we want to encourage that and continue that.
Josephine Jason and Paulina, Princess of Power, happy anniversary, Lucky Chang.
Thank you.
October 18th. This is your walkout music?
This is what I do my aerial piece to, so you guys can come and see.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll be back after the news.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.